Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, another rash of violence in big Dem cities across America, including Chicago, of course, including Chicago. Four mass shootings in 6 hours leave 38 wounded and six dead was the headline on Saturday. Austin, Texas, Cleveland, Ohio, Chicago, Illinois, and Savannah, Georgia.
Yes, eight people were shot in Savannah, Georgia.
All Democrat-run cities. Mm-hmm. Some, like Chicago, for 100 years. And in Chicago, it was, what, 40 and 3, 40 shot, yeah. 3 dead so far, including a mass shooting in Chatham to celebrate the reopening on Friday night where 10 people were shot, 1 killed.
To put it in perspective, 116 people were shot in total last week in Chicago, 14 fatally.
So I was
That's the headline. 116, excuse me, shot in Chicago.
So I was interested in the reaction that John Cass got on Twitter. I tweeted about it over the weekend, but I'll include our friends and listening audience who aren't in the Twitterverse. Downtown Chicago, street gang wars devour the city. And this was in response to a CWB Chicago tweet, more than 60 shots fired in the loop this afternoon, leaving 23-year-old man dead from Saturday. Downtown Chicago, street gang wars devour the city. Is that controversial? Well, listen to...
No, it's a fact.
He's right. He's describing what is. And so some of the reactions on Twitter that I think are indicative of the mentality in Chicago. Let's get past the politicians for a second. Why don't we? Dimitri Mitchell. Are you actually trying to find a solution or just gloating because the current leadership has different views than you?
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Hey.
There was others as well here. John Cass doesn't live in that hood, as if that matters. There was criticisms about his column generally. There's just all sorts of, like, excuse-making and personally attacking John Cass for just really matter-of-factly and uncontroversially describing what is. Uh-huh. I guess you were right about Richard Daley's failed leadership and that ignorant economic plan he used to enrich his buddies, leaving the common man holding the bag. Our mess now, the scoundrels. That was, you know, a fair comment that at least has some historical perspective. But so much of this is the whole, like, you know, you're just taking cheap shots at the politicians and the police chief politicians and Cook County State's attorney politicians du jour. So if you want to understand why Chicago's been destroyed and turned over to thugs, all you have to do is read some of these criticisms of John Cass's little tweet there. It's your friends and your neighbors propagating that mentality that has Chicago in a death spiral. You understand?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer live, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And it leaves us in a city where you've got the dutiful Chicago Press Corps offering, and the police department, back on their heels, offering tips to stay safe if you're involved in a carjacking. That's usually a good sign when police are providing PSAs on what to do in the case of a carjacking. That sends a good message, right?
Yeah, that's a great message.
But it's not happening, but it would be happening. In addition to, of course, their whatever, protect the pump or whatever the hell that initiative was for them to pump gas for a senior citizens at gas stations so they don't get carjacked.
Right. They wanted troops, or not troops, but officers sent to gas stations, you know, during their shifts to make sure no one got killed. Ridiculous.
Interesting piece in NPR, too, about this violence. Kim Fox's office says Chicago Police Department is arresting the wrong people to curb gun violence. She said the evidence doesn't show that the drivers of violence, or spokes being, are the people who've been arrested for nonviolent gun offenses. State Attorney Fox has long said we need to invest more in violence prevention and a more holistic approach to address the root causes of violence. Oh, root causes. You want to have a root causes conversation, do you, Kamala? Interesting. Happy to have that conversation. We have it all the time here. It's routinely dismissed. No questions about it are asked by the Chicago Press Corps. It's just chasing the murder or murders, shooting or shootings du jour. But it is interesting, this thing that BEZ points up, because actually Kim Fox's office may be onto something, but as per usual, not for the reason she thinks. I talked to rank-and-file Chicago police officer about this. And she said, though she's not allowed to speak regarding CBD policy and so on and so forth, some cops will do anything just to get a gun. I've seen some pretty bizarre things related to that. In my opinion, the amount of shootings is directly related to the fact that the department depleted their detective division and specialized units, which went after truly violent offenders through warrants and in-depth investigations. Now it's just smoke and mirrors. Look at me, boss. I got a gun. Can I get an honorable mentality? By a friend of mine who works on a tactical team just brought it to my attention that her officer upgraded two gun punches he had to felonies, and both offenders had no record, so he is suspicious of this data. He thinks maybe they were doing that on purpose so they could come up with this. The point here is, you know, you're taking the low-hanging fruit because they're just focused on guns off the street so they can have a data point at a weekly press conference that says, last week we took 72 guns off the street. Last week we took 67 guns off the street. So what? Who'd you take them from? And connect that to the incidents of violent crime while you're doing your PSAs about carjackings. So, you know, you can have a poisonous mentality seep into the Chicago Police Department, too. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time. And that mentality is, let's just put some window dressing on this. We're not interested in doing proactive policing because the civilian political authorities don't have our back. So we'll just pile up some stats that sound good, that give the appearance we're doing something important, when in point of fact, that's not what's happening. So Kim Fox, of course, seizes on this to pretend that she's doing something important, which is also not happening. This is just a merry-go-round. You're not doing, you've got a mentality that is not really on point over at CPD, which provides cover for my mentality, which really is not on point over at the Cook County Prosecutor's Office, which provides cover for the entire city's mentality, which has no appreciation for the body count that's piled up every day and every weekend.
Year to date, 298 killed, 1,360 wounded from gunfire.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Sounds like the Wild West.
Wild West wasn't that wild.
Yeah.
Hey, Dan, how you doing, man? And good morning, Amy. Yeah, it's Craig. Anyways, you know, what you expect here, what you were getting to in initially, Dan, was we got all these leftist, Marxist politicians, but then we can shed some blame to the people, our neighbors, who are the leftists and Marxists with their Biden and Harris stickers that voted for these people and continue to vote for this kind of garbage and everything. And so we get these kind of policies and everything that absolutely destroy, and this is what they want to do, destroy our system of justice and our quality of life and destroy America and everything. It's at the root of it with the schools, with everything, and they're teaching our kids to be idiots and everything. Dan and Amy, I don't know what we're going to do and everything, because that group is, you know, like large enough to vote these rotten people in.
Thanks for the call, Craig. It's not about but voting is a representation of their mentality. And again, one of my favorite observations is from Ludwig von Mises. He wants to improve conditions, must propagate a new mentality, not merely a new institution. We're in the business in Chicago and Illinois. We just throw up new institutions, meaning programs, expand existing government agencies. We never talk about the mentality, the self-defeating, borderline culturally suicidal mentality, as I indicated with some of the comments made on John Cass's regular, frankly, uncontroversial tweet. So you got to get between people's ears before you see an improvement with respect to violence on the streets of Chicago and in these other cities run by those Marxists that Craig was referring to.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Attendant to perhaps the most catastrophic public health response in human history. This was the comment that Harvard medical professor Martin Kulldorff offered on our show last week, talking about the lockdowns and associated policies. Policy choices. Choices. Not because of COVID, because of the choices we made in response to COVID. Well, here's, as I said, something attendant to that. Perhaps the greatest ripoff of our money in American history. Felix Salmon, Axios. Criminals may have stolen as much as half of the unemployment benefits the U.S. has been pumping out over the past year. Half. That's like $400 billion. Blake Hall, CEO of ID.me, a service that tries to prevent the kind of fraud, told Axios, America has lost more than $400 billion to fraudulent claims. As much as 50% of all unemployment monies may have been stolen. Haywood Talco, the CEO of LexisNexis Risk Solutions, estimates that at least 70% of the money stolen by imposters ultimately left the country, much of it ending up in the hands of criminal syndicates in China, Nigeria, Russia, and elsewhere.
70%?
Of the money stolen. And half of all of the unemployment benefits distributed in the last year. $400 billion. Is that a lot of money? Susan Crabtree, our friend over at RealClearPolitics.com, reports that fraudsters have made off with an estimated $200 billion in state and federal unemployment funds during the pandemic, according to some congressional estimates. So there's a range here. I mean, again, if you're so incompetent as to allow that level of fraud, it's going to take a while and a lot of forensic auditing to actually figure out just exactly how much we're talking about. But we're talking in the hundreds of billions. At least that's what experts and your congressional representatives are talking about. Hundreds of billions, mainly, according to that one expert from LexisNexis Risk Solutions, going to foreign criminal syndicates.
I know somebody stole my dad's identity, was collecting unemployment while he was in prison. That was a big deal.
Susan Crabtree reporting, California and more than a dozen states, both red and blue, unprepared to handle the massive influx of unemployment claims. That almost sounds like the mail-in voting. Unprepared. Massive influx of unemployment claims, according to a Labor Department IG report released last week. But a lot of the waste, fraud, and abuse could have been avoided. 40% of states did not comply with federal rules requiring basic safeguards, cross-checking of unemployment claimants against the National Directory of New Hires, as well as a federal database of illegal immigrants, according to, again, the IG at the Labor Department. The report focuses on California as well as Florida, Georgia, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, Washington, and, of course, Illinois for special scrutiny. Anybody want to ask Jelly Belly about this? How much Illinois taxpayer money went to foreign criminal syndicates in China, Nigeria, and Russia, fat boy. This is probably going to go down in history as the biggest ripoff of taxpayer dollars ever, said Representative Jackie Walorski of Indiana, who is the top Republican on House Ways and Means. The House Ways and Means Worker and Family Support Subcommittee, I should add. Oh, and by the way, this is relevant in real time, not just because, you know, in headlines that FBI got some of that Colonial Pipeline ransomware Bitcoin back.
Bitcoin back, yip-de-doo.
A couple million bucks in ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline.
We're talking $400 billion.
Anybody want to scramble our federal and law enforcement and global spy agencies on this job? $200 to $400 billion. That's the estimate.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And you know, you may want to get to the bottom of this, see where the pitfalls are in terms of the operation, because more than 2.3 million new stimulus checks have been sent in the last week. $4.2 billion worth of payments to Americans. That was last Wednesday it was announced. In total, more than 169 million payments worth about $400 billion have been issued since Congress passed the American Rescue Plan Act just in March. $400 billion more since March. We're talking about close to $1 trillion over the last year. I mean, wow. Is that a big deal? Does that get anybody's attention? Or, I mean, are we really so inured to being bribed with our own money that as long as they just keep announcing they're printing money and drop shipping it off to you, and you get at least some of what you applied for. The fact that you got foreign criminal syndicates, and by the way, not limited, much of the rest of the money stolen by street gangs domestically have made up a greater share of the fraudsters in recent months. Mm-hmm. So our homegrown street gangs plus foreign criminal syndicates, if they take, you know, 50%, 60% skim off the top, it's not a big deal. As long as I get mine, we can print more. What is happening to this country? I can't believe that other than Jim Freeman over the Wall Street Journal, this is barely getting any.
We're the only station going to be talking about it in Chicago.
Well, and
guaranteed.
And some of the good reporting by people like Susan Crabtree and even over at Axios. And I don't get to say that much. Felix Salmon over at Axios. That is hard to comprehend. But you better start thinking about it. Oh, and we'll get to more wonderful public policy coming out of the pandemic in a second. A Harvard Business Review analysis of the minimum wage. Oh, golly, what did they find? They found that Economics 101 is still in force, even if half the country doesn't believe in it. Tom in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Wow, you really hit a spot with me this morning. I have two nephews. They live up in Flint, Michigan. One of them received a check for over $7,000.
Wow.
Because they realized, hey, I should file for unemployment. So it was retroactive. And he didn't work. He didn't even have a job. So I don't know how he got it. Another nephew got one for over $3,000. He had worked about a week at Burger King. And it was over $3,000. Again, retroactive because they didn't know they were supposed to be getting it. Dan and Amy, this is the tip of the iceberg. And I know that I hope some of my friends aren't listening because I'm going to maybe call them out. I have friends that I know, some of them are millionaires. They run small businesses. They took the PPE loans. They didn't need to. They have plenty of money. I have others who probably net worth $500,000. They were trying to apply for food stamps. And I'll tell you what, it really bothered me when some of these people would come back to me and say, well, it's available. So why not? It's available. Why not take advantage of it? I'm thinking because you should let people that need it take advantage of it.
Yep.
And this is the tip of the iceberg, the money we threw out the window.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, I mean, this is the kleptocracy. We know this well in Illinois. Hey, cut me in or cut it out. And as long as I get cut in, then whatever. So now we've exported. We really exported it under President Obama. But it's not just, it wasn't just him in his eight ignominious years. This is a cultural phenomenon that certainly exists in the deep blue states, but to some extent exists in America writ large, and it's going to be our undoing. This idea of cut me in or cut it out, and if you cut me in, then I don't care what you steal, as long as I got mine. Tell me that isn't how Chicago and Illinois operate.
Well, they keep throwing money at us. I mean, the fact that we get EBT cards with $450 on them.
Who's we?
Any parent who has a child in CPS.
Yes.
And there's a lot of millionaires who send their kids to Chicago Public Schools. And there's a lot of poor people who send their kids to Chicago Public Schools. And they didn't vet or check your income before they just throw money at you. It's like they're trying to buy votes. It's disgusting. But if you send your kids back to school, EBT card is cut off.
Dan in Lake Zurich.
Hi, good morning, guys. I just wanted to make a comment about all the stimulus money, how they keep sending it out, but I'm still waiting on a tax refund that's pending since March.
I know. I finally got mine.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Thanks
for the
call,
Dan. You have to wait months.
So here's the thing. The people who play by the rules take it in the shorts.
Yep.
You play by the rules, you're a sucker. This is the same thing we saw happen coming out of the 2008-2009 recession. When we're supposed to, you know, drop everything and liquidate whatever needs to be liquidated to save the 1 in 8 people whose home had gone into foreclosure.
1 in 8.
But the 7 in 8 people whose home didn't go into foreclosure, they're uninteresting. The 7 out of 8 who continued paying their mortgage, who didn't get upside down, who were not taking HELOCs out to buy speculative income property and so on and so forth beyond their means, they're not interesting. The bailouts of Wall Street banks, bailouts on Main Street. That didn't happen in 2002, 2008, 2009. There's no lobbying clout there for those small businesses. They effectively shut them down in 2008, 2009. Now, it was this time it was so comprehensive, the lockdown, that you had to PPP everybody. But again, do we care as long as I'm getting cut in? I'm getting some of that funny money. Chris and Kerry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. So I've got three instances that you can then, that I can personally and friends of mine can personally trace back to all the stimulus money and the fact that people just don't want jobs. In my industry, I deal a lot with supermarket supply. We've been waiting for 4 months for container ships to be unloaded off of San Leonardo, California, waiting in line because they've said they don't have enough people at the ports to unload these container ships. 4 months for products. I have another person, a friend, who works for a huge industrial supply company. They have trailers sitting in their yards because they don't have enough people to unload them. They've increased their starting salary hourly by $5, still no takers. I have a cousin who works in Detroit, sewer contractor. They are offering $80,000 to dump drivers and can't find anybody because everyone wants to stay home. It's affecting everyone. It's craziness.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Good stories, good anecdotes. And again, we know that this will persist, particularly in states with big government governors, until the fall when the benefits start to run out. Paul in Barrington.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I think when people hear that, you know, $400 billion, they may not realize that that's $400,000 million. And I looked in the Trib and the Herald and Sunday, not a mention, not a story. I mean, any company that would lose that much money, the stockholders would be up in arms and the presidents of the companies would be fired. I don't see the outrage by our politicians.
Totally.
Or by anybody.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
I mean, we are stockholders, aren't we?
Allowing this kind of waste and fraud to occur would have people going to prison, not just losing their jobs. This kind of, I mean, you know, you're essentially, at some point, you're essentially in on the fraud when you are so cavalier with other people's money that it's so readily stolen, that your company is so easily defrauded. Well, obviously there's not that sort of accountability in the public sector, but I suppose there could be accountability at the ballot box at some point. Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, I don't know, Dan, if you're aware of, but there's a lot of convenience stores, specifically gas stations. Yes. They're installing these Bitcoin dispensers or Bitcoin receptors where you can buy Bitcoin. And basically, it just gives you a very convenient way to launder all your money.
Well, thanks for the call, Bill. I mean, I understand that there are some who use Bitcoin for illegal activities. Oh, by the way, I was having this conversation over the weekend with somebody. There's a lot of people who use American dollars to launder American dollars in furtherance of illegal operations, too. So I don't know that that's particularly uniquely Bitcoin. I mean, I understand the anonymity and the enhanced ability it provides, but I'm not sure that that's fundamental to the issue we're talking about here. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning. I find it really interesting, about the so-called insurrectionists, the armed insurrectionists that didn't have any arms. And a lot of them are, I think, still being held in jail without any kind of hearing for basically trespassing. And this is what our DOJ and our FBI has become. They are a tool for the Democrat Party. They're working against its own people, and they're more interested in propaganda and making anything that is perceived as take care of yourself, conservative value, making it look bad. And this is what our country's become. All the standards for anybody working in government have been lowered, so-called anybody can get a job, and it's this is what you have. This is what you have, and it's very, very sad. I don't see any end to it, really. You, Dan? You see any end to it?
Thanks, Marvin. Not at present. I don't. Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I think if somebody were to tell Pritzker that Rauner's getting this money with these extra link cards because his daughter went to a Chicago public school, he would cut it out completely. But what you have to explain to these people is the government does not have a pile of money. It does not have earnings coming in. It doesn't even have taxes coming in to redistribute this money. Mm-hmm. They are borrowing from banks. Every time they launch a program like this, the main beneficiary are the bankers, guys like Bill Daley and Chase. You're not getting money from your government. You're not getting your tax money back. You're stealing from your children and your grandchildren.
Yeah.
And eventually it's got to stop, or we're going to become a client state of China.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. I don't disagree with what you said. The problem is the fact that you have to explain that to so many people is why we're in the situation we're in, and we will continue to be. That's the sadness of it all. Oh, and by the way, I mean, in terms of something else you shouldn't have to explain to people, but you do.
What?
Harvard Business Review. The evidence of the unintended labor scheduling implications of the minimum wages. Yeah. Here's what Harvard Business Review researchers did. They looked at a data set of wage and scheduling data for more than 5,000 employees at a single national retailer, compared outcomes for workers in California with those in Texas, where California, they had several min wage increases. Texas, they had none. They found that in the stores that experienced the minimum wage hike, workers on average worked fewer hours per week, were less likely to qualify for benefits, had less consistent schedules. These factors correspond to an average 11.6% decrease in compensation for every dollar increase in the minimum wage. It's counterintuitive unless you passed an Econ 101 course, but that's the reality. And yet what's the hue and cry right now from the Democrat socialists? We don't have a labor shortage. We have a wage shortage. The minimum wage increases plus the artificial wage inflation, not enough, as we heard Chris from Kerry describing. More suicidal economic policy. the minimum wages, along with, obviously, the welfare state issues we were describing.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, out northeast and Exeter.
Yes.
Exeter High School, which is a rather famous prep school for the children of elites, generally speaking. You know, up there with like Andover.
Oh, yeah.
Had a COVID prom, or at least the COVIDians dominated how the prom would operate at Exeter. Any student who didn't have a vaccination card would get marked with a black Sharpie, and students who had gotten the jab were given a red mark.
On their hands or on their foreheads?
Yeah, don't know exactly. Why does the unvaccination mark have to be black? Vaccination, no vaccination, black. Vaccination, red. If they were on the dance floor, they had to raise their hands after every three songs so their numbers could be recorded by other underclass students for contact tracing purposes. You know, it's never too late to train them to be lives of others, sentinels of the state. Our student and parent feedback has been extremely positive regarding the prom experience. We are aware that some concerns have been expressed that students were signaled out or had their privacy violated. Oh, really? Their privacy violated? The markings, you mean. But we made every effort possible while adhering to contact tracing guidelines to ensure that did not happen. Really? Every effort possible. You marked them and you had them raise their hands.
Numbers written on their hands, not their foreheads. Yeah.
No model's perfect. This model let the students enjoy a close to normal and highly desired experience to cap off their senior year. That's the memory we want to leave them with. Oh, I'm sure they'll remember.
And the country was going to remember, too.
Yeah, we'll all remember Exeter's prom now.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
How was, I assume you went to prom again this year. How did it go with the proms you attended?
I went to visit one prom. We had prom in the parking lot.
Is that what you're calling it now, visit?
Yeah. Well, I had to scope it out because, you know, they're trying, you know, the principal over at Amundsen, she's doing a great job trying to make things as normal as possible. And we didn't have money to go on the Odyssey or to Navy Pier. So we had a parking lot prom, and
it was
gorgeous.
Is the Odyssey operational?
Yeah, no, it's working. Yeah. But,
great. Because,
you know, things are back to normal, Dan.
What about the Sea Dog? Is that up and running?
Yeah, it sure is.
Oh, good.
So is the Ferris wheel.
Fantastic.
And guess what? Bubba Gum Shrimp is open.
Lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll see you there at noon.
Yeah.
No, but they did a good job with the prom, but they didn't mark or ask people about their vaccination status. Because that's against HIPAA rules. And I went to the Cubs game, by the way, on Saturday and sat in a vaccination section. Nobody asked to see your card. It's over. Okay?
Well,
and by the way, they never did. They never asked people.
Is there a designated vaccination, unvaccination section?
There was up until Friday, but there was. And I heard and I found out that they never, even if you sat in the vaccinated section at Wrigley Field or at Guaranteed Rate, they never actually asked because they can't. Your vaccination status. It's against HIPAA rules.
Yeah, well, don't tell that to Exeter.
Mirrors. And the whole thing with Governor Pritzker and you'll get a free drink or a shot if you get a shot, that's a bunch of bull jive, too.
So what about the scarlet lettering?
Ugh, sick.
What about the scarlet lettering for, not just for kids, but for all of us, particularly the unvaccinated? I don't think you should mark the vaccinated because they're following orders. I think you need to single out the unvaccinated and make an example of them. I mean, they should be, you know, shunned Amish style. They should be social pariahs. They should be pointed at and ridiculed. They should be in constant walk of atonement mode, don't you think? You know, so they can have a memory like those seniors at Exeter. They were told that this would be the protocol before they signed up for prom. No, well, that's all well and good. You know, I say again, you know, how much is the return to normal going to be an actual return to normal, particularly for those who didn't get vaccinated, have not, will not get vaccinated? I wonder. Well, what is school going to look like in the fall? That's still an open question. You still have mask mandates in force for airplanes and K through 12 school systems. Strange.
So, and kids are still in school.
And the good news is you have some kids speaking up. I mean, just some of the top hits of the last few weeks, just to remind us about the courage and, frankly, entertainment that pre-adolescents have provided as so many adults have behaved like frightened little children, have behaved shamefully.
Disgustingly.
And they're the ones trying to come over the top with the shame. Well, you remember, let's see, Sailor Cook from Collier County, Florida.
Hello, my name is Sailor Cook, and I do not like these masks. And these masks are horrible. Like, and one of my friends said that his friend fainted because of a mask. Like, wow, congrats. And you don't even know how these other kids feel. They're breathing in the same dirty air, and my cousin said they're afraid to take off the masks. Great job. You're creating public schools with fearful children. Wow. I'm so proud of you guys. Wow, amazing.
Oh,
and I don't think barely anybody likes masks in schools. Their children are suffocating. You don't know what it feels like. And just, it's nonsense. Seriously. Like, why would you do that? Why in the world would you do that? And God created us so we can be free people. And we're not being free here or at public schools, okay? So I would take your masks off if I were you. And I'm not wearing a mask right now, and I never will as much as I can.
Oh, my God, bless that person.
4 years old. I mean, I love, she's my favorite so far because of the sarcasm. That is the best sarcasm that I've heard from a four-year-old ever. It's fantastic. And you know what? That's exactly what these COVIDians, these idiot circle enthusiasts deserve, is to be ridiculed by a four-year-old because that's where they're at. Wonderful. Thank you, Sailor Cook. Rich in Lockport, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
Hey, I just I wanted to talk to you about some extreme measures that my employer takes. I work in a warehouse. I am unvaccinated, and I, along with the other unvaccinated people, are the only ones in the warehouse that have to wear a mask. Huh. We have to take PCR tests every 2 weeks, and now they have told us that as of July, all our COVID sick time will be taken away. So really, it's the only people that are unvaccinated that are getting punished for this.
There's no question. Thanks for the call, Rich. And, you know, you bring up something that's interesting because we talked about this a little last week and I wanted to clarify something. I gave sort of an incomplete view of where this is at. We were talking about those cadets at West Point that were segregated by vaccinated, unvaccinated, and the unvaccinated were put out to live outdoors in a
tent
and then in a shipping container before they were given their own barracks. And there is this FDA stricture that prohibits mandatory vaccinations if the vaccine is under an emergency use authorization.
Oh.
However, you had this countervailing missive edict issued by the Equal Opportunity Commission back in May, updating its guidance, stating that federal laws don't prevent an employer from requiring workers to be vaccinated. Federal laws may require the employer provide reasonable accommodations for employees because of a disability or religious belief who aren't vaccinated. But the EEOC said a reasonable accommodation might be entering the workplace wearing face masks, work at a social distance, telework, so forth. So this is going to be litigated. In fact, it's being litigated. there was a Houston hospital.
Right, Methodist Houston.
That dismissed a bunch of employees who refused to get vaccinated, a small percentage of their overall number of employees.
25,000 employees, 183 refused to get vaccinated. They filed a lawsuit and they lost.
Well, they lost so far. It got dismissed. The appeal got dismissed. And I'm not sure I'm really compelled by their legal argument. They should have been right here on point with what is actually in black letter in the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The FDA, this authorized the FDA to grant emergency use authorization, also requires the Secretary of HHS to ensure that individuals to whom the product is administered are informed of the option to accept or refuse administration of the product. The FDA's guidance on EUA of medical products requires the FDA to ensure recipients are informed to the extent practical, given the applicable circumstances, they have the option to accept or refuse the EUA product. So this seems to be an area that is ripe for employment law related litigation. And I think you're going to see more of this because, federal administration, these federal statutes and the administrative guidelines the FDA promulgates say one thing, the EEO has said something else, and there's going to be some nuances here to be certain, and there's probably going to be different opinions in different courts, and ultimately this is going to have to get adjudicated at higher courts, perhaps the highest court. So I think it's an open question because of the designation, at least so long as it's an EUA designation and they're not the subsequent clinical trials that earn these vaccines formal FDA approval. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that, which is to say it's not clear. Danielle in St. Charles.
Hi, guys. I was just calling in to let you guys know, there's more drama happening in St. Charles, Illinois. Tonight is a school board meeting, and we have a large group of parents and community members, including students and teachers, that are coming out. And we're really requesting that our school board and superintendent cancel the contract with Deep Equity. They never involved key stakeholders. We didn't want this. We don't even know if it's needed because they never did an audit. So we signed petitions, and we're bringing them forward tonight to the school board to ask them to eliminate this contract. And we want the internal audit done by an outside agency to see if we really have any equity issues, and if we do, I'm sure there may be some, that we address them and see if we can internally address them instead of bringing in a controversial program like Deep Equity.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, Danielle. While you're there, also tell them to lift any mask requirements they're planning on perpetuating into the next school year. Bill on the Northwest Side.
Hi, Dan. Good morning. I just was wondering your opinion on this. Do you think the next logical step would be to load the unvaccinated onto trains and have them put into camps?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Bill. Jerry in St. John.
Yeah, hi. This is Jay Barron, St. John. So there's testimony that was done for the State House just this last week by Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, HB 248. Is pushing back real hard relative to choice and to not penalize any people in Ohio, particularly frontline workers, healthcare workers, to be given a choice and not penalized and be threatened with their jobs. Well,
okay.
It's not only just their jobs, but whether it's federal or it's private enterprise. Private enterprise is running a big risk here because there's no insurance that people can get if they get ill, from the vaccine. That can push back the litigation on the private businesses as well.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Yeah, so in addition to litigation, obviously legislation state by state will vary and potentially be impactful too, but it has to comport with federal employment law. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Yes, finally. Okay, to the caller who called earlier and said he has not gotten his tax return, we just got ours last week after 1 year and 4 months,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And you know why we got it? Because I had my husband call every other week and bother them. So he needs to be persistent and keep calling. And
Candace, you got through on the phone line?
Yeah. Okay, my second point is, Dan, you know how you like to go to the cigar shop, and you control the levers of the TV. What you need to put on is The Secret Lives of Gypsies from 2015. This is the most, I mean, we think we're conservative. Bah. These people are super conservative. It is fascinating to watch this. This, if you want to survive what's coming, be like Gypsies. I'm telling you, everybody in this audience needs to watch that. It's on Tubi for free. It is fascinating. They are so insular and so protective of their people, and it's amazing.
All right. I'm already committed. Thanks for the call, Kenneth. I've already committed to throw my lot in with the Mennonites and the Amish texter.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The list is sparingly few. The number of scientists who chose to put their professional integrity over politics over the last year. One of those on the list, not somebody we've spoken about before, but she did an interview over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal. Philippa Lentzos is a Swiss social scientist who studies biological threats. She belongs to an email group she describes as consisting of ex-Intel, bioweapons specialist experts, former State Department diplomats, and others who've worked in arms control and biological disarmament. As Chinese authorities struggled to contain the outbreak, she recalls, the expert circle asked questions about the pathogen's origin. Questions we're still asking 16 months later, aren't we? The questions, is this security related? Is it military? Is there something dodgy going on? What information are we not getting here? They ask these questions not because we're conspiracy theorists, said Ms. Lentzos. This is our profession. And she, who places her politics on the Swiss center left, thought the conclusion premature that it was, you know, animal to human. Said so publicly. In May of 2020, she published an article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists weighing whether safety lapses in the course of basic scientific research caused the pandemic. While acknowledging there was, as of yet, little concrete evidence, she noted several indications that collectively suggest this is a serious possibility that needs following up by the international community. She was suggesting at the time that it was an accident, possibly an accident, and it needed follow-up. But you know why we couldn't do that?
Why?
It's because Trump said the same thing. And so did Pompeo. And obviously anything that Trump or Pompeo or anybody from the Trump administration says is to be dismissed out of hand. How about now? How about now when we have, you know, now that the parade is formed, guess who's at the back of it? The World Health Organization and Dr. Tedros, that man of integrity, as Tony Fauci calls him. Dr. Tedros saying that lab leak theory cannot be ruled out and China needs to be transparent. Sure, he's banging his invisible gavel.
Well, Biden said the same thing at the G7 summit. Now it's a possibility that it leaked from the lab. Now it's...
Tedros calling out the Chinese is like when Democrat socialists in Illinois call out the corrupt Democrat socialist du jour. Rod Blagojevich, Mike Madigan, Ed Burke, whoever. Oh, my gosh, that's terrible. Right. Okay, Dr. Tedros. Sure.
Dr. Tedros.
Well, one of the individuals, and by the way, National Pulse is doing, the NationalPulse.com is doing some really good reporting on the origins issue. And they're digging up comments at previous conferences involving the principals from the virology lab, from NIH, from Fauci's NIAID agency. Oh, yeah. And including Peter Daszak, who is EcoHealth Alliance. That was the person who emailed Tony Fauci after he dismissed the lab leak theory as a conspiracy theory. Remember the Fauci emails that were released. Thank you for dismissing that. Thank you for correcting the record.
Yeah. And Fauci just went along. Mm-hmm. Didn't push back, didn't question it.
This is Peter Daszak from EcoHealth on the Chinese government from just last month and what we don't understand.
Great question.
Yeah, one thing that I heard from the lab director that I thought was very interesting, he said, "In you know," and he speaks okay English, and he said, you know, we were asking him all these questions about, they call them rumors over there, we call them conspiracy theories. And he said, basically, in sort of his version of English, we've not responded to those rumors because if you do that, you give them oxygen. So I think people misunderstand the Chinese government, and he's a Chinese government worker at senior level running a lab, not speaking up about when they're accused. The reason is, he stated quite clearly, they don't want to give oxygen to these conspiracies. They're unfounded. And every now and again, they make a statement that is simply not true. What do you do? And we asked them those questions, and they said the same things.
Mm-hmm. He was a point person on COVID-19 for the WHO as well, Peter Daszak. So that's last month. A episode of the This Week in Virology podcast, EcoHealth Alliance, COVID-19 investigator for WHO, Peter Daszak. Don't confuse the Chinese silence as an admission for anything.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay.
And they're not letting anybody back in that virology lab, by the way. Their investigation's over. It's done.
Peter Daszak also said that there were no bats being used for research at the Wuhan Virology Lab. Alive,
well, that's not true.
Alive or dead.
Oh, there. Richard Engel from NBC News got into that lab, and there's bats. They had
Richard
whole,
Engel is a clown.
I know, but I'm saying there are bats there that were dead and alive that they were doing research on. There's video of it.
Yeah.
Unless that was something.
No, that was not.
Fake news.
That was not the Virology Lab. That was an investigator independent of the virology lab that he relied on for the conclusion that it was animal to human transfer. By contrast, Sherry Markson over at Sky News Australia generated some, well, got her hands on some footage. And this is what she found and reported.
For 15 years, they do not have live or dead bats in them. There is no evidence anywhere that this happened. It's an error that I hope will be corrected. Well, tonight, explosive footage from inside the Wuhan Institute of Virology indicates his statements are wrong. It is not a conspiracy to say there were live bats at the lab. It is a fact. And as you can see, this video shows bats in a cage at the Wuhan Institute. You can also see there a researcher feeding a bat with a worm. And in this image, we can see researchers out capturing bats, and a bat even hangs off a researcher's hat. In another image, there are mouse cages, hundreds of them. We know that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was using humanized mice for experiments to see which coronaviruses could infect humans. In some experiments, they used the humanized mice to make viruses that couldn't previously infect humans do exactly that. These experiments, called gain of function, aim to make viruses more infectious and more virulent to try and predict which may cause a pandemic. This footage, had it been available early last year, may have reshaped the entire narrative around the potential origin of COVID-19.
Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what? I've been listening to this COVID argument for years or whatever. And the thing is, if the Chinese even said, hey, you know what? Yeah, we released it. We did it. What are you going to do about it? Absolutely nothing. Instead of saying Fauci lied, which he probably did, the media is covering up. Why aren't people asking, why is this place even in existence? They're not designing new potato chips or anything like that. They're doing stuff that will kill masses of people in a time of war. That's the primary reason for that particular lab. And there's others, and there's even some in this country. So to say that Trump was out of his mind, Well, that just shows you the liberal media. But China, no one's going to do anything about it. They got carte blanche to do whatever they want. Have a nice day.
Well, it matters, as we've talked about before, the origin matters because it can pin countries down that otherwise don't want to take a tough line with China, including the United States, at least under this president. It's a very different thing for China to run around being able to say the outbreak occurred in Wuhan and we contained it and we did a better job than the West because we have, you know, a superior model. The Chinese Communist Politburo managing the affairs of a billion Chinese people, and we're ready to tackle the world. We're superior when it comes to central planning, and central planning is superior to market-based economies. Versus, it escaped. You tried to cover it up. There are compromised international agencies, which we should no longer support, like WHO. And in point of fact, you didn't do a better job. What the virus origin tells us is that central planning is not the right model, that you are not superior to the West when it comes to how to organize a society, and you should be pinned in, not allowed to export your model of organizing society around the world. This is important because you see socialists in certain places ascendant again, and most recently Peru. This is important because some spines in the West need to be stiffened. So the truth of what happened is absolutely relevant. And sort of the kind of nothing will happen. Yeah, maybe short term, maybe with this administration. But it matters medium term beyond this administration. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I keep hearing prominent conservatives and others say, like Dr. Fauci said, why would the Chinese invent a virus that could kill them too? Well, what if they invented the virus first, developed a vaccine, inoculated their leadership and whatever population groups they wanted to protect, and then released it? That would be the whole reason to weaponize the virus in the first place. And how do we know that this wasn't a test run for later use? I mean, this was a virus that was 99% survivable. So if, as a practice run, what happens when the Chinese get gain of function on a virus that has a 50% survivability rate? You know, this is why we need to know exactly who was responsible for either accidentally releasing the virus or intentionally releasing the virus. And that people are saying, are using Trump as an excuse not to do this. They are the modern useful idiot that used to defend the Soviet Union. That's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Well, that's the sort of layering to this is, yes, we have to find out the origin, and that necessarily means, was it intentional or accidental? That also matters. Absolutely it does, because it demands different responses from, as I said, Western nations and Western leaders that, you know, have a tough time stiffening their spine when it comes to their economic relationship, ourselves included, their economic relationship with the Chi-Coms, doesn't it?
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Joe Biden over at G7 across the pond in England. And after he got done elbow bumping all the world leaders in attendance, and I think they all had an opportunity to also bitch slap Emmanuel Macron, just in principle, like the French are doing.
And the main theme is America's back at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Did we ever leave?
He was asked, was Joe Biden, about Trump-era steel and aluminum tariffs on EU countries. And he had this to say to reporters.
When you're having these conversations with European allies who are very concerned about these sanctions, how do you justify that? And what are your plans?
120 days. Give me a break. Need time.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Dear, what was that? Was it Clint Eastwood? Get off my lawn.
Yeah, 120 days. In addition to the dramatic Vader voice.
Yeah, he's a victim now, too.
120 days. You've been in office for 50 years. What is complicated about the decision on steel and aluminum tariffs? How many days does it take? It's buffoonery. And that was complemented by his robust discussion of Russia as it relates to countries in the region and opportunities for America to work with Russia, even though Russia's not a good faith actor.
Where we could work together with Russia, for example, in Libya.
Syria.
We should be opening up the passes to be able to go through and provide food assistance and vital assistance to a population that's in real trouble. I think Libyan. I'm going to try very much hard to. It is. And by the way, there's places where I shouldn't be starting off and negotiating in public here. But let me say it this way: Russia has engaged in activities which are, we believe, are contrary to international norms. But they have also bitten off some real problems. They're going to have trouble chewing on. And, for example, the rebuilding of Syria.
Libya.
Of Libya.
Syria.
They're there. And as long as they're there without the ability to bring about some order in the region, and you can't do that very well without providing for the basic economic needs of people. So I'm hopeful that we can find an accommodation that where we can save the lives of people in Libya.
No one spoke in his ear like, sir, you have the wrong country.
I think he should redraw that red line that Obama drew in Syria, but this time draw it in Libya. For more on this, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of the recently released Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you. That was just painful to listen to, I got to tell you.
Sounds like Biden was biting off more than he was able to chew as well.
So I had, I did a piece for Fox that's coming out. I kind of, like, three takeaways from the G7. One of them, actually, you just played there, which is, ironically, kind of the dopey grandpa thing works. I mean, everybody is, Biden is a pleasant. He's actually not a pleasant guy, but his public persona is quite pleasant. And that plays. Actually, the other president who did this was Eisenhower. When Eisenhower came into office, he famously kind of adopted this kind of, grandpa thing. And it worked. And it was the Cold War was heating up. Americans kind of needed that calming influence. But Eisenhower famously had this very hard hidden hand. So behind the scenes, he was a very strong, proactive president, and actually produced some of the best bipartisan initiatives in modern history. The problem with Biden is, I think, behind the scenes, we aren't seeing a strong hidden hand that's pressing good bipartisan things. So one is, I think that's the whole, we love the dopey grandpa thing, that's going to work then. The second one is Biden is really good at finger-waving and magical thinking. And so far, that seems to be most of our foreign policy. This notion about Syria, for example, which is utter nonsense. So in the end, what you're saying is, we will help the Russians strengthen the totalitarian genocidal regime in Syria? Because that's really all the Russians are interested in. And this there is no common ground between the United States and Putin. It's nonsensical to do that, but basically what we have from the president is a lot of kind of rhetoric, which is either kind of finger-waving, I told him not to do that, like, you tell the kids not to mess up the living room even as they're, tearing the couch apart, or this kind of magical thinking, like, oh, yeah, we'll figure things out. I think the third thing, which doesn't get enough coverage here, is a lot of this is just this administration using foreign affairs as legitimatize a very aggressive domestic agenda. I think the number one thing where we saw, you know, we saw that with the climate change, for example, which is really nothing about global climate leadership. It's about an excuse to do all kinds of nutty stuff here at home. I think we saw the same thing at the G7, this discussion about global minimum corporate tax. That's just about looking for international validation on corporate tax as government, as a key government policy, an excuse that he'll use when he comes back here home. So, well, we have to do this because we have to, you know, purport to global norms. So,
well, it looked like the world leaders at the G7 summit were, excuse me, falling all over themselves to be with Biden and to, you know, make it look like everything's better in the world. So has America's image really improved since Biden took office, or is that just for show?
Well, so that's super interesting because there was some polling that came out which says Biden has kind of introduced this more interesting, more popular image of the U.S. abroad. But what's really interesting is when you go underneath those numbers, there's actually less confidence in American leadership. There's less confidence in American democracy. There's less confidence that America is going to do good things in the world. So it goes back to this. We all love the kindly grandpa thing, but actually we hate Biden's policy. We actually did a piece on this on the Daily Signal over the weekend. If you look at the kind of the 12 top issues in America, from voter integrity to, you know, Antifa and BLM in our streets, Americans and Joe Biden are on a completely different page. His popularity is still hovering at like 50%. But when you actually ask, do you like Biden's policies, he just falls off the cliff.
And so Biden is behaving the same way these mealy-mouthed other Western leaders behave with respect to the Chinese communists. They sort of mumble about consulting,
right,
and collaboration and accountability, and they don't really mean any of it because they're not willing to risk the economic relationship. And this is where the rest of the West wants America to be the bad guy, and Joe Biden is not going to be the bad guy with respect to the Chinese communists or the Russians, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, we saw this in spades. We came out with a joint statement that says we want the WHO to investigate COVID and we want China to cooperate. The two things that we know will never happen. Right. And then we all pat ourselves on the back like, aren't we strong? I mean, what nonsense. I mean, look, Beijing's getting ready to host the world's most important sporting event on the earth, in the universe. And they're in the midst of not only having created a global pandemic, but in one of the world's most atrocious genocides. And we're all just going to go to Beijing and pretend that didn't happen. The G7 could have said, you know what? We, the G7, demand that the Olympic Committee postpone and move the Olympics. They could have done that. That would have angered China to no end. That would have got their attention. But this was mostly, the G7 has always been kind of a nothing burger with a side of nothing. This one, I think, in some ways, is even worse than that. It reminds me of the little kid in the grocery cart steering the little wheel, thinking he's driving the grocery cart down the aisle.
Well, it's worse because it's emboldening the West's enemies and America's enemies in particular.
I do think, yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason why the Europeans are all enamored with Biden is they just think he is a tool they can kind of drive around. Certainly Macron thinks that, oh my God, I have a kind of absent-minded, Chartsy Gardner American president who I can, you know, play like a puppet. This is awesome. But, and I think it's either that or, you know, we need America, you know, much in the way many, you know, European leaders or foreign leaders were kind of had awkward relationships with Trump. They still had very strong working relationships because they needed America. So there's nothing good that came out of the G7 that we can all go to and say, yes, you know, Russia, China, and Iran are all hovering around their destiny. Oh, my God, how are we going to deal with these guys? It's exactly the opposite. I think they're all thinking, like, well, what can we get away with next?
All right, so Vladimir Putin told NBC News that U.S. relations with Russia is at a low point. Biden is refusing to have a press conference with him, you know, but he wants answers about cyber criminals. And Russia said, yeah, we'll give you the information if you give us information. But why not stand side by side with him in person and ask him directly while the whole world is watching?
Because the whole purpose of this trip was to just roll Biden out there and kind of look presidential and get away with the minimum amount of risk and gas. And so this is just minimizing exposure.
With respect to issues at home within our government, you know, more and more information coming out about the relationship between scientists at the National Institutes for Health and at the Wuhan Virology Lab. And something, and this is, I don't think, been covered very much, but the National Pulse had it. Dr. Richard Barrick, who was one of the scientists named by Rand Paul in that now infamous exchange he had with Tony Fauci that has led to all of this additional investigation that is unearthing all of the conferences and cozy remarks that were the bon mots shared back and forth between Chinese scientists and American scientists over the last decade plus, including on the topic of gain-of-function research, which Richard Barrick, Dr. Richard Barrick, opposed the moratorium on gain-of-function research. But something he said during a 2018 speech, imagining the next flu pandemic and preventing it, that was the title of his talk. There was a slide in his presentation, Global Catastrophe, Opportunities Exist. The slide outlines what type of stocks and industries surged during the Ebola outbreak, which he uses to extrapolate financial advice on how to make money in the next pandemic. I'm quoting him. I want to give you good news. There are winners out there, right? So if you ever want to be prepared and make money in the next pandemic, if that's what you want to do, buy stock in hazmat suit makers and protective clothing or companies that make antiviral drugs for the particular pandemic. He added that those sectors and stocks would probably do pretty well, quote unquote, and they're actually mutual funds for pandemic preparedness, he noted as well. It's interesting to have Dr. Richard Barrick, this scientist in the infectious disease space, offering in a conference about pandemics just 3 years ago, this financial advice about how to make money to those in attendance at the conference. Do you find that troubling at all?
Well, it seems inappropriate. You know, I would also say it also seems pretty freaking obvious that, personal protective stuff is going to be. But, you know, the other problem, of course, is, and this is the one thing people should not forget, and these, look, all diseases present themselves differently. So how you dealt with the last pandemic may or may not be, or the next disease outbreak may or may not be appropriate for the next one, because viruses behave differently. There's some are airborne transmission, some are transmitted by services. So, you know, I think we do have to be careful that somehow that, you know, we've learned all the lessons here. But there seems to be a major problem here in that it looks like for at least 15 years, we have had relatively reckless interchanges on the scientific level with China and other people. And I'm not sure we've adhered to ethical standards. I'm not sure we've adopted best practices. I'm not sure we've done due diligence on all these things. And, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, I've heard people in Congress incessantly demand an investigation of January 6th. But you have a pandemic that's killed 600,000 people, and every day we have new questions about the appropriateness and of how we prepared, and nobody wants to investigate that.
Yeah, you know something else too. There's a good piece by Perry Link, who's a professor of Chinese at University of California, Riverside. It's amazing to me how little our diplomatic corps either knows or pretends to know about how the Chinese communists operate. He points out that the linguistic evidence is overwhelming that Chinese leaders believe the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the source. Many years ago, a distinguished Chinese writer explained to me there is truth in Communist Party pronouncements, but you have to read them upside down.
Right.
And he goes on to say, this Chinese writer told him, you're too hung up, you in the West, too hung up on the question whether propaganda is true or not. For the regime, truth and false here beside the point. A statement might be true, false, or partly true. What matters is only whether it works. Does it advance the interests of the party? And so we're taking, so many people, at least in public, are taking statements emanating from the Chinese Politburo at face value.
Face value, right.
When in point of fact, we know that they're not to be taken at face value.
Yeah, and the reality is look, I mean, our intelligence community knows that. You know, my guys who work on this stuff know that. I mean, we know that, and yet we in at and a global forum, the U.S. government says the route to understanding what happened here is we have to have the WHO investigate more, and the Chinese have to cooperate, knowing for a fact that both those things are absolutely off the table with the Chinese government. And does that not make us look just idiotic? Not just in the minds of the Chinese government, but anybody with half a brain.
Well, it also indicates that you have people purposely lying to their constituents, meaning those people saying that, the Biden administration officials saying that, are lying to the American people. And that's terribly problematic.
Well, they've been lying. I mean, look, this is part of the shtick. I mean, they completely fabricated the response to the border. Look, this is, you know, we found basically that for 4 years we relied to virtually everything about Trump, that Trump didn't do anything as they claimed he did. Mm-hmm. And now, but what we learned in those 4 years is you can lie to people for a really long time and get away with it. And that's what they're doing coming out of the box. They lie that, you know, HR1 and HR4 are about voting integrity. They're not. They're about a power grab. They lied that the infrastructure bill is about infrastructure. It's not. They lied that the COVID response bill was a COVID response. It wasn't. They said the border was just a temporary seasonal blip. That's a lie. And these actually are lies. I mean, it's not even manipulating the truth. And some of these are just lies.
Yeah,
so when the national security advisor gets up and says, we're going to press the Chinese to you know, come clean and the WHO to investigate this, he knows that's not going to happen. That's a lie to the American people.
Well, when people make comparisons between the Democrat Socialists and the Maoists of the Cultural Revolution era, boy, that's more spot on than they'd like to admit, isn't it? Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at Heritage and author of the book Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And for those who don't think there is an ideology that connects identitarians, I submit another exhibit for your consideration, and that is the unintentionally hilarious piece by ABC7 Chicago's Evelyn Holmes over the weekend profiling the drag queen or trans LGBTQ plus BLM parade. You got all those vowels and consonants?
A lot going on there.
LGBTQ parade on behalf of Black Lives Matter.
Well, it really truly was a celebration, but of inclusion, sure, but with a distinct purpose. That drag march for change happened once again in this Northside neighborhood.
Drag march.
Trans lives matter!
They marched demanding equality and racial justice.
Unless we do radical change, nothing's going to change.
Once again, the drag march for change took to the streets on Sunday afternoon.
As a Black man, it's very important for us to be here supporting the LGBTQ community because it helps us understand how we intersect and overlap.
Although in its second year, the protest stepped off at Belmont and Halsted in the city's LGBTQ neighborhood, formerly known as Boys Town. It is, though, 70-year-old Brian's first time here after coming out to his family and friends at the start of the pandemic.
And it feels great.
Today's march had an expanded message of inclusion for the Black transgender community and other marginalized groups.
Inclusion of trans people especially.
Organizer Joe Mama, who is also known as local bartender Joe Lewis, says there has been some positive change over the last year, but nearly not enough.
So we really need seats at the table for Black and brown faces and bodies and experiences.
Supporters of the protest march want the city to reduce Chicago police budgets by 70%, redirecting those funds to social service and community programs. They also want uniformed police banned from marching in pride festivities. But for 57-year-old transgender woman Raven Bonte, the day is about acceptance and love and being okay with who you really are.
And all I'm asking, just let me be a human.
Now, they also had speakers at the end of the march, which is about four or five blocks just north of where I am.
Yeah, that's enough, Evelyn. LGBT, just let me be who. Let me be a human.
A human? Really?
Oh, okay.
Someone's denying you that right? Mm.
I'm also just fascinated by the 70-year-old who came out just prior to the pandemic. Came out, what, 69 years old? Okay.
Hey, it's never too late.
Sure.
Never too late, dude.
Yeah. It's fascinating. For commentary on this and this whole topic area of the LGBTQ plus with the emphasis on T, pleased to be joined again by Abigail Schreier. She's a writer living in Los Angeles and author of Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. And oh, by the way, we're giving away copies of Abigail's book, Irreversible Damage, in June. To enter, to get a copy of her book, go to 560theanswer.com/books, 560theanswer.com/books. Enter by the end of the month, by June 30th. Abigail, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
What about marches like the one we just profiled here in Chicago over the weekend that are all about inclusion and seats at imaginary tables and voices and experiences and so forth?
Well, I think that the gay movement traditionally was about those things, but what's going on now is very, very different. And the reason is because gender ideology, that the ideology that insists that anyone who says they're a woman really is a woman, that biological boys can compete in girl sports because they're entitled to it, and that parents have no say in whether their children transition medically, that's a very different movement. It's a very different ideology, and it really strikes at the heart of the American family.
So in your book, Irreversible Damage, I mean, did you interview and talk to people who got the surgery and then wanted to take it back, so to speak? Because I know there was a 60 Minutes piece a few weeks ago where they focused on people who regret the decisions that they made.
Absolutely. That's the reason I wrote the book. So if these young women, I wrote the book about young women who are suddenly out of nowhere, you know, after never before experiencing so-called gender dysphoria, the severe discomfort in one's biological sex, never experiencing it in any significant numbers, they're now the leading demographic. And so the book took a real look at why. And of course, because these young women don't have traditional gender dysphoria. They don't. It seems to be more of a social contagion. There are very high rates of regret. And if these young women were transitioning and leading happy lives, you know, very content as the opposite sex, I never would have written the book. But unfortunately, they're going through, you know, irreversible damage, and the part of the damage is the regret.
You wrote a piece for City Journal that included a couple of anecdotes, too, about how sort of the state is aligned against the parents when it comes to navigating these issues with their kids. And one anecdote in particular, you tell the story of a Pakistani immigrant and the problem that he and his family had with their son and how that interaction with the state ensued after they checked him in for some mental evaluation.
That's right. I mean, he was one of several parents I talked to where they took the kid in for a real, genuine mental health crisis. He, at the time, was suicidal, this young boy who was also autistic. And the state And Seattle Children's Hospital made it clear that they expected the parents to affirm the new chosen gender, something he had chosen while very vulnerable during his stay at the hospital, and affirm him and start him on a path to medical transition. And if the parents wanted them back, they were sort of expected to do these things. And it was one of several parents I talked to. The laws in states like Washington, Oregon, and California give enormous powers to minors to go ahead and start medical transition and make parents powerless to stop them.
I remember back in the day when you had to go through a year of counseling before any surgeon in America was allowed to touch you. When did that go away?
Well, part of the change, there were a few changes, and one of them was in 2012, WPATH, which is the large, the umbrella transgender health organization, decided that medicine should be available on an informed consent basis. That means, and hormones and surgeries should be informed consent, meaning all a patient needs to do is sign a waiver that they're aware of the risk. So it becomes a lot like an amusement park ride. You're whatever the long-term risks. You don't need mental health counseling any longer. You don't need, to try out to make sure this is right for you. You just sign a waiver and you walk out that day with a course of testosterone. And depending on the state, you could be as young as 15 in the state of Oregon, or perhaps 13 in the state of Washington, and go ahead and get started.
You mentioned this, at least in part, the product of a social contagion. There was a study done a few years ago now, by Lisa Littman at Brown University about this very topic, whether or not the spike in people identifying as trans was the result of social pressure and social media and the communication and persuasion that goes on those platforms. And, of course, Lisa Littman was then immediately sidelined, and there was a hue and cry by most people about her research because they didn't like the conclusions that were drawn. Talk more about the social contagion and what we should understand about that as a relevant factor in this discussion of kids moving back and forth in terms of their identity.
Sure. So we know what gender dysphoria looks like. It was traditionally, we have a 100-year diagnostic history, and this severe discomfort in one's biological sex was always, it was predominantly little boys. It came on ages 2 to 4, and it was little boys very insistent that they were the opposite sex. Now, out of nowhere, the leading demographic is teenage girls with no childhood history, and it's clustered in friend groups, meaning if your friend group, decides it's transgender, it's a much higher chance that you will as well. Mm-hmm. These girls are going to Planned Parenthood clinics together in groups. They're giggling in the waiting rooms, as one Planned Parenthood ex-employee told me. I mean, the Planned Parenthood is a very, very large distributor of testosterone, and they're doing it sort of as a celebratory experience, but also a way to escape their very real pain that they're in. They're in a mental health crisis, very similar to anorexia, bulimia, and other instances in which teenage girls shared their very real pain and decided this was the problem. I'm so fat, or in this case, I'm really a boy.
Important, going back to that anecdote you shared about that Pakistani immigrant and his son and his family. If you say the wrong thing when it comes to going against whatever some clinician at the gender clinic says, or what your confused child is saying per their conversations online, then it can quickly escalate to Child Protective Services.
That's right. That's what I'm finding. So not only, are therapists and doctors, incredibly pressured to perform so-called affirmative care. That's immediately affirm the patient's self-diagnosis and start them on a course of testosterone. But now I'm hearing that parents are, the moment that they are not on board with, affirmation and, beginning a process of medical transition, that this can vary quickly escalate into a situation where their custody is threatened.
Hmm. This may seem like less important than obviously, physical procedures on people, but culturally, When people say in reaction to people putting pronouns after their name or when they close a letter, he, him, she, her, they, theirs, blah, blah, blah. Hey, look, if they want to do that, what's the big deal? Who does it hurt? What do you say to the who does it hurt argument?
It's interesting. So, you know, I suppose it depends on the context. Like, I you know, I don't have a massive problem with people using their own pronouns. The problem is the coercion. And right now we're seeing a tremendous amount of coercion, especially with young kids. Kids in school who show up who are socially awkward, who are struggling with mental health problems like anxiety and depression, they find, you know, and this is predominantly white girls, they find that the one way to gain acceptance is certainly not by getting having the white identity, but by escaping into an LGBTQ identity where they might get more acceptance. And so you're seeing extremely high rates of trans identification. And look, if this were just about identification, I would never have written the book. Unfortunately, they're being fast-tracked to hormones and surgeries, and these are highly risky and experimental.
Well, it's a moneymaker. I mean, look at Lurie Children's Hospital. They have a whole, you know, gender reassignment wing in their hospital now.
It is a major moneymaker, and I'm told by surgeons that unfortunately it's such a huge moneymaker that very often the people administering these treatments are in no position to do it. They haven't had the training that you really ought to in peripheral nerves and things like that before you perform the surgery.
But it seems to me, you know, the pronoun thing, the, you know, who does it hurt? What's the big deal? You know, sort of the same deeply robust argument that was made in favor of or with tacit acceptance of marriage redefinition. You know, this is all part of a cultural tapestry, and you're popularizing something by participating in a lie about children's biology or about biology, generally speaking, when you have adults and heads of organizations saying, you can call me he, him, or she, her. To me, it is impactful because exactly what you're talking about, it aids and abets the social contagion that you're seeing at the local level. Now you see adults, now you see people in positions of authority, successful people participating in this falsity.
Yes, I mean, I suppose I would say, look, I have no problem. You know, I know a lot of transgender adults, and I certainly use in you know, when I'm in the conversation with them, I use whatever pronouns they would prefer, and I have no trouble doing that. The problem is I do think it becomes dangerous when we engage in public lies like trans women or women, and it causes it does you know create all kinds of unintended consequences because of course. They aren't trans women or trans women, but they aren't women. But the moment you commit yourself to lies like that, you can't explain why they don't belong in, say, you know, a battered women's shelter or
right.
a prison.
Right. Yeah. You can't explain why men aren't birthing people, as Joe Biden's budget would have you believe, for example. Abigail Schreier, she's a writer living in L.A. She's the author of Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. And again, we're giving away copies of her book, Irreversible Damage, in June. 56theanswer.com/books. Enter by the end of this month, June 30th. Abigail, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Asheville, North Carolina, following in the footsteps of Evanston, approving $2.1 million in reparations for black residents. This is a majority white community, Asheville, North Carolina. City plans to spend $200,000 on the planning and community engagement process. Sure, consultants have to make some cash. And about $1.9 million on initial reparations. Huh, yeah. We truly want to have a better understanding of what has been the policies that either currently exist or have existed in the past that have impacted the lives, particularly of black people in Asheville, said the city manager. We want to identify and understand the current disparities and the needs and what we should really be focusing on. It's all very confusing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
New rules every day.
Here's something you could focus on. where are these equity warriors when it comes to K through 12 education? And the way that urban school systems in particular are set up, deriving from redlining from a bygone era. This is the topic of a op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by our friend Darrell Bradford, who is the president of 50CAN, an education advocacy group. He's out of New York. Where you live often determines which public schools you can attend and which schools you can't. Amid a national racial reckoning and a housing shortage only getting worse, you'd think equity wars like the nation's teachers' unions and urbane progressives with access to the best schools would be fighting to overturn a policy rooted in 1930s-era redlining. But don't hold your breath. They helped design the system, and they're invested in it for the long haul, which is why a solution that frees families and unleashes our creativity is the best solution available. More black voices in favor of school choice, but of course they don't get any quarter in the education establishment or the urban press corps that are tools of the education establishment, the government educational establishment. But it is interesting. It certainly runs counter to all of this counting by race and driving equality of outcomes. The only outcome they're interested in within that system, the government school system, my salary, my benefits, my ever-evolving conditions for coming to work in a public school system, as we saw over the pandemic. For more on the move away from meritocracy and choice, for that matter, pleased to be joined by Richard Bernstein, former reporter, culture critic, and foreign correspondent at Time Magazine and The New York Times. Richard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you did this piece for RealClearInvestigations.com where you've documented how quickly we're moving to counting by race and discarding meritocracy in sort of every sector of American society, documenting a lot of what we've documented on this show, too. And in corporate America, perhaps second only to academia in leading the way for America in this direction.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how everybody is jumping on that bandwagon, isn't it? But, I mean, some of it, especially in education, has been going on for a long time. Effective racial quotas, different groups being admitted to the elite schools with very, very different academic records and very different test scores and all that. But what seems to be very new in the wake of the George Floyd incident is corporate America choosing to put into place basically racial quotas in hiring. And once you've decided that you're going to choose people on the basis of their race, then you've really eliminated the possibility that an equal standard can apply to everybody.
Well, and when, for example, and you mentioned this, United Airlines says we're going to train 5,000 black and female pilots over the next decade or so on and so forth. That's all well and good. I don't really care what gender or race my pilot is, but I do care if my pilot is only being selected by their gender or race.
Yeah. That's certainly the message that the United Airlines announcement suggested, that, you know, they of the 5,000 new pilots to be trained in their flight school, 2,500 of them have to be minorities or women. I mean, there was no particular indication that the pipeline will provide them with 2,500 black or women pilots. You know, I mean, United Airlines has a very keen interest in not crashing its airplane.
Yes.
So, you know, I have a feeling with that particular instance that, you know, if they can't meet the quota, they'll quietly drop it, and that there was a certain amount of virtue signaling in the announcement in the first place. But the principle that we're going to hire on the basis of race or sex is set in that statement.
Well, the other thing, though, in that instance is, you know, when you're just trying to get to a certain number, then there's places to put people to sort of hide them just to make your number. And that's not productive for an organization or for the safety of an industry where safety is preeminent, like the airlines either. you know, that it's your focus is where it shouldn't be, which is what you're saying.
Well, and also the underlying ideology is that the United States is this fundamentally flawed, systemic racist country. It's as if we haven't been confronting racial disparities over the last 50 or 60 years with corporate America, of universities, the churches, the whole society, the media, considerably mobilized to try to redress the balances that we all know do exist and that we all would like to have redressed. It's as though this is all something entirely new, and the failure to succeed is due not to individual effort on the parts of people who have been left out, but somehow it's systemic. It's the entire racist society that's at fault.
Well, let's talk about the Ivy League schools and some state universities, because they're not even accepting standardized test scores to give minorities a better shot at admissions.
Right. Well, I wrote a piece, actually, that I'd invite your listeners to read for Real Clear Investigations on how the University of California system decided exactly on that, on phasing out the SAT, even though a faculty investigation found that the SAT was actually helpful in finding qualified minority candidates. But what happened there is so interesting. The Board of Regents, which is consists not of academics, not of professors, but of business people and famous people in Hollywood and that sort of thing, had a meeting which was public. I listened to it, and you could sort of almost feel the skepticism about eliminating the SAT on the part of quite a number of the regents. But then somebody will get up and say, the SAT is racist. And immediately, all of the opposition to eliminating the SAT kind of fades away, because nobody wants to be accused of being a racist. And so the Board of Regents voted, I think unanimously, to eliminate the only measure that the university system had, the only common measure, to measure the qualifications of applicants. And they did that in the face of faculty opposition.
Well, the good news, though, is that those test scores as indicators of likelihood of success at a particular school, they don't really matter anyway, because if you want to be an English major, you don't have to read Shakespeare. If you want to be a classics major, you don't have to be exposed to Latin or Greek. If you want to be a math major, you can spend all your time arguing whether 2 + 2 actually does equal 4. In certain circumstances, maybe it does. In certain other circumstances, it doesn't. So, in terms of the quality of the actual scholarship at these institutions, frankly, what is the barrier to entry? It's not like it's rigorous, the academic standards, in so many respects.
Yeah. Well, what you're pointing to is the way the entire kind of liberal establishment, its various parts work in kind of concert, so that the decision of one decision is then justified by another decision. If some people aren't doing very well academically, well, just give them good grades anyway, and then you're justified in having admitted them in the first place.
Yeah, in high school, what do? Eliminate AP classes. Don't make anybody feel bad.
Gosh.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
Yeah. And there's also one thing that doesn't get treated in the media, including, my former newspaper, the New York Times, is that there's a group of very articulate and very well-informed black conservatives.
Yes.
That see this as insulting to the black community. The idea is that black kids can't make it, and therefore we have to treat them differently than we treat white kids and Asian kids. And they object to that. People like John McWhorter at Columbia University, and he specifically has been writing about the decision of the classics department at Princeton to eliminate Latin and Greek as a requirement for a classics major, saying, what, black kids can't learn? White kids and Asian kids can learn Latin and Greek, but black kids can't?
Well, you see, Richard, The New York Times doesn't have space for Glenn Lowry or Shelby Steele or John McWhorter or Bob Woodson because they're too busy doing deep dives with Kevin Hart, as they did this weekend. Kevin Hart, the comedian, who says, much like some of those members of Ivy League boards of trustees you were referencing, quote, "You're witnessing white power and white privilege at an all-time high. For those who say they don't understand that or don't see it or are confused as to what that means, I'm going to say you're part of the problem." It's one thing for a comedian like Kevin Hart to, you know, prattle on ignorantly. It's another thing for Ivy League boards of trustee members or professors or people who are serious people to be completely backed down by someone just saying, this is what's happening. If you don't see it, you're part of the problem. That's not an argument. That's not an edict. There's nothing evidence-based about that. It's just your view that's based on, well, nothing except probably what you heard somebody say over at the 1619 Project. That's not good enough, but it is good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange and disturbing how this how adherence to an ideology has become kind of requirement for acceptance into the good graces of liberal society. That if you don't toe the line, you're out. And I think, you know, a lot of people just want to get on with their lives and do their work. And they don't want to get involved in all this stuff. So they kind of go along, or they don't speak out against what's happening. You know, this kind of growth of an intolerant orthodoxy that really has kind of taken over liberalism. I mean, I still consider myself to be a liberal, although it's becoming harder and harder to do that. But I'm talking about, you know, the old-fashioned liberalism where you could openly debate things. You didn't assume that if somebody disagreed with you, it was because they were an evil racist. But you accepted that the world is a complicated place, and there are many different views that are legitimate, and we can talk about them. The whole debate about this issue has been snuffed out by that accusation of racism.
He is, you know, actually it recalls Milton Friedman talking about racism and, you know, and his opposition, frankly, to anti-discrimination laws. Basically said, I want to punish the racist. You don't. You know, if there's two shoe stores right next to each other and the one shoe store hires salesmen based on merit and the other shoe store just hires white people because he's a racist, guess who's going to have the better shoe store with and ultimately the better outcome for his business? It's, of course, the person that's hiring based on merit, not based on race. And it seems to me this is a market opportunity for those, maybe even in Fortune 1000 America, who want to stick to meritocracy. Same thing with educational institutions who want to stick with meritocracy and not go down this primrose path of the, I would call them the new racists. But I guess we'll see what happens. Richard Burke. I'm sorry, go ahead if you wanted to comment on that.
No, I was just laughing, just, you know, saying that, yes, of course, we will see what happens. Yeah. Absolutely.
Richard Bernstein, former reporter, cultural critic, and former correspondent at Time Magazine and The New York Times. Check out his piece, which I'll tweet out at realclearinvestigations.com. Almost overnight, standards of colorblind merit tumble across American society. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, once upon a time, I really enjoyed Steve Kerr because, of course, he was one of the guys who benefited from Michael Jordan's return to the tune of three championships. Kerr replacing Paxson as the sharpshooter. Highest three-point shooting percentage in NBA history, Steve Kerr. Great fun to watch as a compliment on Michael Jordan's championship teams. And then, you know, embarked on a coaching career. Very successful, of course, as we know,
yep,
particularly with the Warriors. But recently, as the NBA has become more politicized and sports leagues generally, professional sports leagues generally, so has Steve Kerr. And it all started with a dive into the NBA's relationship with China that really came to the forefront when former Houston's GM Daryl Morey was rebuked for daring to side with Hong Kong protesters against their Chinese communist overlords. And Steve Kerr, who was freewheeling with his commentary on matters political and policy, was quiet when it came to those protests in Hong Kong, those Hong Kongans protesting for freedoms similar to those enjoyed by we here in America. Steve Kerr had this to say about that topic at the time.
Actually, I don't. I mean, it's a really bizarre international story, and a lot of us don't know what to make of it. So it's something I'm reading about, and just like everybody is, but I'm not going to comment further.
It's a bizarre international story. It's difficult to comment on. He was going to seek counsel from his brother-in-law, Chinese history professor, so he could figure out what's going on with these young people protesting for freedom against communist overlords in China. It's real complicated. It's interesting because Steve Kerr had no problems comparing the United States to China when it came to human rights record in defense of China. But he's a problem rallying to the defense of Hong Kongans in pursuit of freedom. Interesting.
It has not come up in terms of people asking me about it, people discussing it. No. Nor has our record of human rights abuses come up either. You know, things that our country needs to look at and resolve, that hasn't come up either. So none of us are perfect, and we all have different issues that we have to get to. And saying that is my right as an American doesn't mean that I hate my country. It means I want to address things, right? But people in China didn't ask me about, you know, people owning AR-15s and mowing each other down in a mall. I wasn't asked that question. So we can play this game all we want and go all over the map and, you know, there's this issue and that issue. And the world is a complex place, and there's more gray than black and white.
Yeah, let's play this game, Steve. A criminal killing somebody is equivalent in terms of a comment on society as the government setting up concentration camps for a minority group of Muslims to the tune of 1 million people in China, for example, repressing Hong Kongans, for example. Let's talk about that, Steve. Let's get Steve Kerr talking. I wonder how freewheeling he was in furtherance of this new biography on Steve Kerr from Scott Howard Cooper, who's an award-winning sports journalist and author of Steve Kerr, A Life. Scott Howard Cooper, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You know, sorry to focus on politics when I'd rather talk about sports, but unfortunately, Steve Kerr and so many in the NBA have forced basketball fans to talk about politics. So I'm happy to talk about Steve Kerr and go round and round with him. Did you get a chance to go round and round with him on these topics?
Not on these topics, no. I've been a part of the conversations in a group setting with him, but I did not have any one-on-one time with him on that or anything else. He didn't want anything to do with this project and made it clear in a very polite way, said it was nothing personal, but just didn't want that kind of attention. So this book was done without his cooperation. I did not share his thoughts on those matters or any others, but I certainly am aware of his thinking from everything that you've just noted previously.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think formed his opinions?
On these international issues?
Yep.
His life, his entire life story, is his unique background of having grown up in different cultures. His parents and his grandparents have deep roots in the Middle East. They're American citizens, but they had been teachers and college administrators. So he had lived in a lot of different cultures in the Mideast, in Europe, in briefly in Northern Africa, and then a lot in Southern California. And his parents were always encouraging him to be an individual thinker, not just Steve, but his brothers and sister as well. And then as he grew up, he was a college freshman when his father was killed in the Middle East, in Beirut. And then throughout his career, he has crossed paths with a lot of people that have been impacted by gun violence and terrorism. So it's part of his life story that it's not just a basketball story, and it's a unique background, and that is what all comes together to kind of form the guy that Steve Kerr is today.
Yeah, although it's interesting. I don't recall. This is a neutral question. Was he outspoken when he was a player on these topics? Because no. I don't recall that.
He was not outspoken, but if he was asked, he did not shy away from it. It's been one of the several interesting personality changes in his life. As you noted, this is not something he was known for. He was always in the media. People were always going to him. He was always trying to be cooperative, so it's not like he was a wallflower or anything. But you're right, this was not something that he was known for during his 15 years in the NBA. But over time, he's gone from the guy that was willing to speak if asked to the guy that not only was hoping to be asked, but encouraged to be asked. Remember, he showed up at the NBA Finals at a pregame press conference wearing a T-shirt about gun rights.
Right.
So obviously knowing that somebody would ask him about that. So it has been one of the personality changes in his life that now he not only is willing to answer those questions, but encourages them.
Do you think that it's the NBA has changed over the time since Steve Kerr was a player to being coached? Let's say the last 20 years. And even Greg Popovich, too, who likes to pop off on these topics. It's changed so much. I mean, it's so much a players' league, more than it has ever been. And do you think these coaches feel pressure to sort of run cover for what they're hearing from players, particularly outspoken players like, I don't know, LeBron James, but others? And so they need to feel like they need to step out in order to, you know, continue to enjoy their post as a coach and continue to have the fealty of their players?
I think, and this is obviously just anecdotal evidence, there's no actual survey that's been done, but my sense from having been around it for all those years is that everybody has become a lot more outspoken, not just the NBA, but society as a whole, not just professional athletes, but certainly everybody. I don't think, if you're asking me is that why Steve has changed and become more outspoken, the answer is no. I think this is who he is.
Okay.
He's not trying to run cover for anybody. He is who he is, and is willing to live with the people that don't like it and embrace the people who do like it. He's always willing to have the conversation. He doesn't necessarily want the argument, and he doesn't want...
Clearly. Clearly he doesn't want the argument. He just wants
to... But he'll have the conversation.
Yeah.
If it's somebody that's going to be accusing him of saying that he's just doing it to run for cover or different things like that, that's a different matter. But I think he has shown a willingness to have the conversation with people who disagree with him. He's been doing that for many, many years, back since he was a general manager, long before he got to the Warriors. So Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, some of the other people, this is not them trying to look good for anybody. This is who they are and what they believe, and they're going to stand up for what they see.
And by all accounts, I mean, Steve Kerr is a wonderful man. I mean, I've met him, been to his house in Tucson. My mom was his insurance agent, and I was at a party at his house. Ricky Birdsong was there, and Brian Williams was there, and Sean Alley was there, but there was like 20 of us. And both Brian Williams and Ricky Birdsong were killed in gun attacks. I mean, just think about how, violence is so a part of Steve Kerr's life, with his father being assassinated and then two of his friends getting shot.
Well, I don't think we know that Brian Williams, Bison Daly, I don't think we know that for sure that he died from gunfire.
Well, his brother shot him on the boat in San Diego.
Did he shoot him? Do we know that for sure? Because I don't think
the body was never recovered, yeah.
We suspect certainly that he was killed, but we don't know how it happened. But that's a minor point. But even more so than that, a lot of the people that he connected with through life were greatly impacted, and people know the stories in Chicago. Obviously, Michael Jordan, lost his father. Scott Williams both of his parents in a murder-suicide from gunfire. Ricky Birdsong was very popular with everybody who met him. And you go down the line, Pete Myers. His mom was worked on UCLA campus in the Fulbright program, and there was a murder-suicide when Steve was coaching the Warriors. So this has been something that has become all too common to him in his life, and that's why I said that obviously his father is certainly the number one factor in his beliefs on gun violence and gun rights. But there have been many other times that he's been surrounded by these issues as well. And I agree with you that he is a great guy, and that's coming from somebody that he made this project difficult on. But you've been there, you know how people feel about him. And you can disagree with him on a lot of his political stands, and obviously people will. But even people who are on the other side of him find him to be a good person.
What do you think the future is for the NBA with, the handle right now, as you've undoubtedly heard, is that America is no longer the NBA's primary market. It's China. And this has been only increased in terms of profile and discussion over the last year plus during the pandemic. As somebody who covers this beat, what's your take?
Well, I don't know that I've heard that America is not the NBA's primary market. Certainly they're going into China, and it's a huge investment, and there are a lot of moral issues for them to wrestle with as they do it, but it's not like you've turned their back. The NBA has not turned its back on the United States by any means. I think that to your larger question of the direction and the NBA's future, I think that they need to become more clear themselves on how they want to speak about this relationship. If you're dealing with China in particular, there's no question that they have badly mishandled the China situation. There's been a lot of hypocrisy. There's been a lot of mangled statements, and that includes Steve. And when he tried to duck and dodge, as the clips you played at the top of the segment, that was, to put it in basketball language, it was a terrible turnover. He really mishandled that, and he came out later and said he mishandled it. Steve Kerr can rest on a lot of different statements when it comes to any issue, whether it's domestic policy, foreign policy, basketball, but he cannot say, "I was not aware. I don't have that much information." Right. As you said, his brother-in-law is something of a China expert. Steve is a guy that has always been known to read the media, watch the news, newspapers, magazines, online. He certainly was up to date on anything to do with protests in China, so he badly mishandled that. And what Steve needs to do is decide on his stance moving forward, and that's the NBA as a whole. As I said, they've really mishandled the whole situation. And I think that moving forward, a key thing for the league is to decide what is their public stance on this and how are they going to back it up.
Do you think Steve Kerr could start right now today as the shooting guard for the Bulls? I think it's possible that they bring him back.
Yeah, well, I would say he had trouble starting in his prime for any team. So with his knees that are shot right now and some of the back problems, but I think that was more of a question regarding the Bulls roster than about Steve's ability. I saw that dig in there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you picked up on that.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. I think if you put him out on the court now and he didn't have to move and put a burn in those knees, that he could still hit his share of standstill jumpers, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Bulls don't move on defense, so what's the difference? Scott Howard Cooper, he is the award-winning sports journalist and author of Steve Kerr, A Life. Scott, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.